I'm very happy now to welcome journalist and scholar Hale Esfandiari. She is the founding director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Middle East program. She's former deputy secretary general of the Women's Organization of Iran. And her new book is My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. She will be speaking this Friday, November 13th, at 5 o'clock at the Unitarian Church in Santa Fe in a lecture and book signing sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and it's a pleasure to read this beautifully written and very interesting book. You grew up in Iran with a really multicultural childhood, Austrian mother, Iranian father, international travel and studies. And as a teenager, you lived through the overthrow of Mossadegh in the British and CIA coup. What memories do you have of this? What was your experience of that event at the time?
Well, I was 11 years old, and every single child, every single adolescent was galvanized by the Mossadegh period. You know, he felt his mandate was to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company. Until then, the Iranian oil was in the hand of the British. So this gave us a sense of pride, nationalism. So we were all politically motivated. So as I describe in my book, even children my age were in the, if not in the streets, they were in the school constantly demonstrating and being very excited about what was happening. And then, of course, it was the coup. And Mossadegh was overthrown, and the Shah returned to Iran, and everything went back to normal. We minded our own businesses. We went back to class. Gone was the excitement. And then I grew up in a calm and serene Iran until the revolution, of course.
So by the time you finished university in the 1960s, you spoke four different languages. You became a translator and then a journalist at the major daily newspaper in Tehran, where as a woman in your position, you were the first woman doing what you did. You weren't at first treated with respect from your colleagues. Tell us about your work with the Women's Organization of Iran and the situation of women at that time that varied, as it probably still does now, from one class to another.
I had started my career as a journalist, but then as censorship became more and more in the paper, I had decided that I need to make a move. And it was during that period that a group of young women had joined the Women's Organization of Iran, and I got an offer to join them. And the years I spent at the Women's Organization were very formative years. So we put together the family protection law, and for the first time, Iranian women had the right to go and seek a divorce. Child custody was given to the mother. Family courts were set up to look into family disputes, and the age of marriage was raised from 13 to 15 to 18. Women had access to employment. Women had more access to education. And on the eve of the revolution, you had women ministers, you had women ambassadors, you had women deputy ministers, you had women policemen, you had women university professors, you had business women. So women were everywhere, but, you know, we still were not satisfied, and there was a lot that needed to be done.
How did it change after the revolution?
One of the first decisions of the revolutionary government was to suspend the family protection law. And as I explained earlier, the family protection law gave women the right to divorce, made polygamy almost impossible, raised the age of marriage for girls and boys, for girls to 18, for boys to 21. The family protection law was suspended. The family courts were closed. And once again, men had the right to, the unilateral right to divorce their wife. Men had the right to marry four wives if they wanted. The age of marriage was reduced to puberty, which is 9 in Islam. Not that every single girl was married off at the age of 9. Today the mean age of marriage is 19 or 20, but still the law said puberty. And it really took over 15 years to raise the age of marriage for girls from 9 to 13. Child custody was taken away from women and given to the father or the male member of the family. So basically, women lost a lot of their rights. Women also, access to education stayed for them, but the revolutionary government toyed at first with the idea of segregating universities, but they soon found out that they didn't have enough professors. So what they decided was that women sat in the back and men sat, male students sat in the front, or, they set up different entrances at the university for girls and for boys, and girls and boys were not allowed to mix on campus together and talk to each other, and buses were segregated. Men could sit in the front, women had to either stand or sit in the back, and men and women who were not related with each other were not allowed to be seen in public or mix and mingle in public places. The veil was reintroduced. It became the official dress code for Iranian women, and not observing the proper dress code was punishable by 70 lashes. And all the stoning was reintroduced. And there were a number of women who were, and men who were stoned for adultery. So all these things took place, which really harmed the status of women.
As you describe in the book, there are cycles of reform and then the return of hardline conservatism in Iran going back many decades, I mean really to the early 20th century, and it certainly expresses itself in the domain of the position of women. What are some of the other areas of personal and political life that conservatism and reform is seen in Iran?
Actually, if you go back to the earliest 20th century, between 1900 and the late 1970s, when the revolution took place, the story of Iranian women had been a gradual progress. Actually, they never had a setback. It was gradual, but it really was moving ahead. But it was after the revolution that when the family protection law, which was very important for Iranian women, was suspended. But then women pushed to reinstate at least some clauses of this, of the family protection law. I mean, they pushed for equal access to universities. And today you have more women entering the universities than men. You have women sitting in parliament. I mean, they are conservative women, but at least you have women in parliament. And for the first time, a woman was appointed to the cabinet by President Ahmadinejad after the recent election. And I think this was his gesture to try and win back to the conservative camp a lot of and great number of women he had lost. But in 2006, a group of really enlightened men and women got together and started a campaign to collect a million signature to and present that to Parliament. Their goal was achieving total equality under the law. The government has been merciless in dealing with the campaign women, arresting them, putting them in jail. When I was in Evin in prison, they were also in jail. Some of the leaders of the campaign, I never met them, but I was told later that they were there at the same time. They are very courageous women, very bold women, and they are not scared or nor intimidated by the government. They are not scared of being arrested, and they continue pushing for equality under the law.
We're talking to Hale Esfandiari, author of the book My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. You and your family left Iran at the time of the revolution. What made you decide to leave, and what did you do when you got to the United States?
My husband stayed in Iran till a year after the revolution. I had gone just to spend 2 weeks with our daughter in London when the revolution happened. So then at his suggestion, because our daughter went to an American school in Tehran and they had, by then the school was closed, he suggested we stay on in London to see what will happen. And the next time I went back was 14 years later. But we stayed in London with my daughter when my husband came. We then went to Princeton. He had a one-year appointment at Princeton. My husband had gone to boarding school and to university in the United States, so it was normal for us to come to the United States, where my husband had spent a great number of years.
You ended up at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and he, a longtime professor in the United States as well. Your mother stayed in Iran even after the death of your father, and in 2006 you went back to visit her. And this is where the story begins in your book, My Prison, My Home. Right after Christmas in December, at the end of December 2006, you were on your way to the airport to leave the country. Your car was stopped, it was robbed, and that was the beginning of a very long ordeal about which you write. When did you begin to realize that this was a political act and not an ordinary robbery?
Within 2 days. Once I was called in for interrogation, I knew that this was not your normal, regular questioning regarding a loss of a passport. For the first 24 hours, I thought, well, okay, I was a victim of a robbery. This is, Tehran is a large city, a metropolis with 14 million inhabitants. Such things happen. But when I went to apply for a passport and I was told to go to, they gave me an address to go, and I immediately recognized that this is the intelligence ministry. So I knew that this was not your normal robbery, and the line of questioning, the kind of questions I got, you know, the tone, the threat, the intimidation, immediately, you know, I noticed that I was in for a lot of problem.
So for months you were interrogated, and it's such a strange story. During the day, you go for interrogation. At night, you go home to your elderly mother's apartment and try to have something like a normal life. And your interrogators, and this one in particular, Jafari, who seems like a literary villain straight out of George Orwell, he had some preconceived notions about what he wanted you to say. What was their agenda? What was his agenda?
Look. They had convinced themselves that the United States was trying to overthrow the Iranian regime through soft means, through a velvet revolution, because, again, they had convinced themselves that the United States was bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan, and this was 2007. and will not resort to military means against Iran, but still would try and overthrow the regime. And since they had studied very carefully the soft revolutions that had taken place in the Ukraine and in Georgia, so they thought the same thing. They were planning, the United States was planning through think tanks, research centers, and foundations to do the same thing in Iran, and therefore the United States would use Iranian-American scholars like myself to be instrument for that Velvet Revolution. And because I used to go regularly to Iran to visit my 93-year-old mother, so I was the top suspect for them. They had referred to me as the big fish. They thought they had caught a big fish.
And day after day after day, you told them about your work organizing conferences and getting scholars to speak to each other and having intercultural exchange and so on. And they just really never believed you.
No. They absolutely did not believe me, because if they believed me, that whole house of cards they had built for themselves would have just collapsed. And they absolutely refused to believe me. So that's why they resorted to threats, intimidation, tiring me out, you know, sitting there every day, 8 hours, 9 hours, and I refused to eat food, you know, and asking the same questions over and over again. And we didn't get anywhere. That's why they decided at some stage that, well, we can't break her outside prison. We can't make her say what we want her to say. So therefore, we are going to take her in.
So then you were put in prison and taken to this infamous Evin prison, which was your great fear all along, and they kept hammering away, and you describe very vividly in your book what this prison was like. How did you survive psychologically, both during the interrogations where you were living at home and then in prison?
When I was living at home, at least I had access to the outside world. You know, I was in touch with my husband. I was in touch with my daughter. I was in touch with my colleagues. I was in, you know, I would go and confine in my mother. You know, but once I was taken to prison, first of all, you know, the shock of being taken to Evin, and the first thing I remembered was that in 2003, a Canadian-Iranian photographer, journalist who was picked up outside Evin was beaten to death during interrogation. So I was very scared. But then I decided that I need to survive this ordeal. And so I have to try and be very focused on the interrogation. And I also have to keep my sanity. And I kept my sanity by doing, whenever I didn't go for interrogation, I did a lot of exercising. I walked for hours, you know, pacing up and down my cell. I would do Pilates exercise. So I was constantly moving. I didn't sit still. And also I composed 2 books in my head. And I was very serious about it, moving chapters, you know, moving paragraphs, editing. So that kept me very busy. Also, I refused to think about my family, because I knew that if I start thinking about my family, I would just be completely useless in prison and would exactly become the person they wanted me to become. And I was completely cut off from the rest of the world. So my world was my cell, my interrogators, and the women guard. And that was it.
We're talking to Hale Esfandiari, author of the book My Prison, My Home. During your interrogation before the arrest, you and your husband had carefully avoided press attention, even while trying to find people who would have influence to help facilitate your release. What did he do after your arrest to bring attention to your case?
As soon as they arrested me, both he and the Wilson Center went public. And they talked to the press, they gave interviews, they got in touch with a lot of people around the world, people they thought who can intervene on my behalf with the Iranian government. Lee Hamilton, the president of the Wilson Center, had a vast network of foreign dignitaries he had met when he was on the Hill. So he contacted every single one of them and asked them to intervene on my behalf. My husband, we also knew a lot of journalists, both in this country and also overseas. So we contacted them. And I was very fortunate to work at the Wilson Center. We have a number of programs dealing with other countries. So all my colleagues got in touch with people they knew in these different countries. So it was an all-out effort was waged on my behalf, and at the end, it helped.
You were in the position, of course, of not knowing what was happening, but there were these little moments where you got a glimpse. For example, the people who were interrogating you tried to get you to sign a document waiving your right to a lawyer, and this was a tip-off that there was, in fact, legal action going on your behalf.
Exactly. And also, my husband and I had discussed the need for me to have a lawyer if I was arrested. So the moment I was arrested, he got in touch with Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, and she told him, look, they won't let me see her. They won't let me see her file, but I can do a lot of noise for her. And when they brought that piece of paper and say, waive the right to have a lawyer, I immediately knew that they did get a lawyer for me. And it was Shirin. Or there was another incident when they asked me whether I knew how I knew Obama, and I said who, and they said Obama, and I said, you mean the senator from Illinois? And they said, yes. How do you know him? And I said, I've never met him. I was one of the several hundred people went to a talk he gave at the Council on Foreign Relations. But then I asked them, why? Why do you ask me this? They said, well, he had talked on your behalf. And that was, June 2007. I just didn't know what was going on in the state, or July 2007. And then I thought to myself, if Senator Obama had talked about me, and he's not even my own senator, so probably there is a huge campaign. There is other people must have been talking about me, too. So this was really a ray of hope for me.
And Hillary Clinton had also spoken on your behalf, as you found out.
Yeah.
And then you were released after 105 days, which, though horrible, weren't as bad as what many other prisoners suffered. What were the reasons, finally, for your release?
Well, I was told that Mr. Hamilton had written a letter to the Supreme Leader and had asked him to let me go on humanitarian grounds. And he had written previously to President Ahmadinejad with no reply, to the Iranian Speaker of Parliament with no reply. But when he wrote to the Supreme Leader, there was a reply for him. And he was called in to New York to go to the Iranian interest section, Iranian mission there at the UN, and he was told that there is a letter for him. And I have never seen the exchange, I've never seen the content of the letter. But I was told that the office of the Supreme Reader wrote to him that the matter of your concern would be resolved. And 3 weeks later, just as suddenly as I was taken in, I was told that I can go home, but going home means going to my mother's apartment, and they will not let me go back to the U.S. And, of course, they have taken my mother's apartment as a bail to let me out of prison.
Reading about your imprisonment and interrogation, I couldn't help but think, and not that you wrote about this specifically, but I couldn't help but think about all the prisoners that the United States has taken in and interrogated in Iraq and in all the various secret prisons and so on. And I felt that your book was kind of by extension about all unjust political imprisonment and the countless people who were denied access to lawyers and to their families, and especially those whose loved ones are not able to organize an international campaign and who are sitting there as we speak.
Sure. I mean, and let me tell you that while I was at Evin, I tried very much to avoid any discussion about Abu Ghraib, for example, or Guantanamo, because I knew that there was no way that I could explain it, let alone defend it. And that's why I believe that it is our duty that to speak about these detention centers, to speak about political prisoners, to speak about even what is going on now in Iran. You have the leadership of the reformist movement in jail. You have 3 American hikers in jail. You have an Iranian-American sociologist who was in jail with me, Kian Tajbakh, was freed a month after I was freed. He was picked up again 2 months ago. I don't think we should forget them. I think it's very important to speak about them all the time, you know, and to remind people that there are, you know, these people sitting in jail, and each of these people have families, have relatives, and we need to help them, sure.
What does your story say about the larger issue of relations between Iran and the United States?
Well, it says that if 2 countries don't engage, if 2 countries don't have relations, if 2 countries don't talk with each other, there is animosity and enmity. Just ordinary citizens like myself and like, you know, many others become victims. They are the victim of the lack of relation, the animosity, and the enmity between 2 countries. In the worst of times, the United States had relations with the then Soviet Union. You know, but for the last 30 years, Iran and the United States have been enemies. And as a result, you know, just ordinary citizens like myself just, you know, end up becoming victims.
It's such a beautifully written book, and it's such a cry for rationality and just simple truth-telling. Under what circumstances do you think that you would ever go back to Iran?
When I left Iran, it was around 3 in the morning. I looked out of the window, and I said, "So long, this is not goodbye." So I hope that, you know, one day I would be able to go back, because for me it's very important to return and visit my mother's grave. She passed away 4 months ago, and I need to put a closure to that. I need to visit her grave.
Hale Esfandiari is a journalist and scholar, founding director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Middle East program, former deputy secretary general of the Women's Organization of Iran, and the new book is called My Prison, My Home, One Woman's Story of Captivity in Iran. And we will see you tomorrow, Friday, November 13th at 5:30 at the Unitarian Church in Santa Fe, where you will be doing a lecture and book signing sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.